Have you ever felt like nobody was there? Have you ever felt forgotten in the middle of nowhere? Have you ever felt like you could disappear? Like you could fall and no one would hear?
Welcome to Between the Covers, a weekly KBOO program all about books and the people who write them. I'm your host this week, Ken Jones. On today's show, our guest is Kai Emmons, author of the new story collection Vanishing from Leapfrog Press. Kai's a fiction writer, playwright, and screenwriter whose previous novels include Weatherwoman, The Stylist, and His Mother's Son, which won an Oregon Book Award for fiction. Her work has appeared in Tri-Quarterly, Narrative, the Arts and Letters Journal of Contemporary Culture, and Portland Monthly. Before turning to fiction, Kai wrote for theater, film, and television. Two of her plays were produced in New York theaters. She's optioned numerous feature-length screenplays, and she wrote for the TV series The Trials of Rosie O'Neill. In the words of writer Marie-Hélène Bertino, Vanishing is sophisticated and bright with promise. These stories elucidate incredibly difficult-to-articulate topics such as jealousy, self-hatred, unlikely connection, and friendship. If a writer's job is to make the unseen visible, the stories in Vanishing are flashlights, illuminating the subtle, enormous tragedies we humans encounter every day. Kai, thanks for joining us today. I think from your home in Eugene, right? Eugene, Oregon?
Yes, here I am in Eugene, Oregon on a beautiful May day.
Yes.
Yes. It's wonderful, yeah.
Now, Kai, we mentioned in the intro that before writing fiction, you were writing for theater, TV, and film. What prompted the change, and what did you find you were able to do in fiction that you couldn't do as a playwright and screenwriter?
That's a very good question. I think that a part of me always knew that I was more of a fiction writer than a dramatic writer. But I had started writing plays in college and got a lot of encouragement from one particular professor of mine, a woman named Audrienne Kennedy, who I don't know if most people are not familiar with her work, but she wrote Funny House of a Negro, along with a bunch of other plays that were produced a while ago in New York, although recently she had something as well. Anyway, she was very encouraging and started connecting me with theaters in New York. And that kind of led to a little bit of the possibility of a career as a playwright. But it was kind of too much too soon. And, you know, I wasn't ready to make that leap, even though I did enjoy writing plays. And when I graduated from college, I realized I needed to earn a living. And because I had this foot in the door of dramatic writing, I decided to go to film school, and I ended up kind of working in film for many years and writing screenplays.
You were a fellow student with several big names in film, including Barry Sonnenfeld, Spike Lee, too? Or?
Yes, and Jim Jarmusch.
Wow.
And yes, and they, you know, they all went on to very big careers, and which is what we all hope to do, but of course it's very difficult to, you know, establish a career as a director, particularly, I will say, for women. My thesis film won a Student Academy Award, which is kind of a big deal. And I met with tons of people about directing feature, but could never quite parlay the situation into directing a feature. And I think part of that is because I'm a woman. At any rate, so when at some point my husband and I were writing screenplays, we had moved by then from New York to LA, and we got to that point in the life of screenwriters, I think it happens to many, where you realize that you are really a victim of the zeitgeist. We wrote one screenplay that every studio president read, which is not that common. I mean, the VPs and the development people will read it, but this was really kind of kicked upstairs until there was one very heady weekend when we were talking about whether we were going to sell it for $3 million or $5 million or whatever. I mean, it was really that moment which you wait for.
I've never had that heady a weekend. That must have been fantastic.
Oh, it was in a way for that weekend, yeah. But that weekend ended. And we didn't sell the script. And the reason why was because it was a political script that was coming in just after an election when people had really had it with politics. And, as I say, it was if we had presented it maybe 6 months earlier, I think we could have made a killing. But because of the timing, it just wasn't going to happen. And it made us realize that we had very little control over what we were doing. We could get better and better as screenwriters, but it wasn't going to affect our fate in the business. Before that time, actually, I had realized that I was not kind of inherently seeing the world as a screenwriter does, or even a director possibly. And I'd always wanted to write fiction, been a little bit afraid of writing fiction, but I'd begun kind of dabbling in it, doing a little bit, kind of almost in secret. And I realized at that point, both of us wanted to get out of film. And I realized at that point in time that it was time for me to pursue fiction. And so I came to Oregon and went to the MFA program at the University of Oregon with the intention that I would publish and get a job there. And even though I never would advise a student to do that, it kind of worked out.
Now, as a fiction writer, you've published three novels with a fourth on the way next year. Yeah. And in previous interviews, you've said that you consider yourself a novelist.
I do, yeah.
And the new book, Vanishing, of course, is a collection of five short stories, with at least one written, I think, before any of the novels. How did the book come about? These stories were written while you were writing the novels, before you were writing, while you were in the MFA program?
When one is in an MFA program, one always has to write some stories. It just seems it's really hard to workshop a novel, even though I have tried numerous times. But so I wrote stories while I was in the program. And one of the stories I wrote way back when I was in graduate school is in this collection. It's the first one in the collection called The Deed. And then over the years, occasionally stories have occurred to me. And I can't say why exactly. It's just a small situation will come to my attention. And I just realized this is not a novel. This is a story. And I'll take time out to do that, but it's very rare. And I don't have tons of stories lying around, but I had these five and a few had been published. And I thought, I looked at them and I began to see a thread of connection between and among them. And so I put them together and I sent them off to a contest, and they won this contest, and the contest came with publication. So that is the story behind this collection. These stories were written over a period of 20 years. So I feel kind of lucky. And and I love having the closure of having all these stories not all these stories, there are only five of them, but having these stories together and seeing in some way that they really belong together.
Oh, they definitely do. Actually, the next question I was going to ask about that. Vanishing, of course, is the title of the book, and it's there's a title story called Vanishing in there. And there's a thread of invisibility, of disappearing, of identity, and the lack of it that ties all the stories together. You mentioned the first story that you wrote as a student, The Deed. The narrator says in there, "After a while, I began to realize they could not even see me." In the next story, Fat, here's a quote, "Did people come to this city to be anonymous or to prove they were not?" In Redhead, "After a while, Morna had lost track of who she was with him." And in the title story, Vanishing, here's a quote, "He hadn't called her once since the separation, and she felt gone to him, along with all those years they spent together. Poof." I love that poof. Now, once you found the connecting thread in the stories, did you revise any of them to kind of emphasize that motif, that sense of vanishing?
I did not revise them around that particular thematic thread. I wanted to kind of leave the stories with faint echoes of those things rather than coming down, on the nose on that theme. And, I think if I decided to write a collection about women vanishing, it would have been a little heavy-handed, shall we say. So I didn't rewrite around that, but I did rewrite the first story because I had her at one point going into a laundromat or no, using a payphone. And I thought, well, this is really doesn't fly now. And I didn't want to point out that that was a story that was written in advance of the others because they all seem like in this sort of indefinite present, should we say? Not a clear, well, pre-pandemic, we will say that. But other than that, not particularly tied to a year.
That's true.
Or a decade.
That's right. There's really no kind of no news events or anything in there
that I
remember from the stories.
It's unusual for me in that regard because I usually feel that the climate, the cultural climate is kind of a backdrop, a scrim on what I'm writing. I mean, for Weather Woman, certainly, you know, the whole climate crisis is there. My first novel, His Mother's Son, was written after there had been a terrible school shooting here in the Eugene Springfield area. And so there was that in the backdrop. And even The Stylist has a transgender element, a transgender character, I should say. And that was written actually before the mainstream was discussing transgender issues, but I was kind of, I think I was anticipating it. It had been always been something on my mind. So in that way, there's a real interaction with my characters, with the culture at large.
That theme of vanishing and that loss of identity, it applies to all the main women characters in the stories, which I think why it works so well thematically. But you and I talked about Weather Woman about a year and a half ago when that came out. And the character, title character, the Weather Woman in that novel, Bronwyn Artair, she's a weather woman on TV, a meteorologist, and she discovers she has the power to change the weather. Was that written somewhat in response to the women in Vanishing, these kind of women who discover how little power they seem to have versus this woman who all of a sudden acquires this amazing power that nobody else has?
Yeah, I mean, I think it both Weather Woman and Vanishing and probably all my books kind of indicate what is on my mind a lot and in my mental landscape, issues to do with power, women and power are always circulating. I mean, I think about this a lot, how on the one hand, this is a time of women being empowered. On the other hand, women continue to have trouble getting their voices heard in boardrooms. And I was listening to some women on a climate panel just yesterday, and these were all really, really accomplished women. One was a climate scientist, one was working at the World Bank, and one was, what was the other one? Oh, has been working in air quality control in LA since the 70s. And all of these women talked about how they're often in meetings where men will talk over them, or they'll put forth an idea and it will be reviled until a man takes it up. And I mean, this is an ongoing concern for them. So here are these women who are on the one hand, super empowered, and on the other hand, still not empowered. So yeah, so I think about these issues a lot.
Now, of the stories...
And apparently I have been for years.
Right. Going back at least 20 years.
Yeah.
Now, of the stories in the book, the one that really stayed with me, kind of haunts me, is the first, The Deed. I'll just give the listener a little kind of a summary of it. Yeah. The narrator's an attorney, and she's a mother of two young children. She's home with the kids one night. Her husband's away on a business trip, and she finds a man in the house. And the man claims it's his house. And he makes a pretty convincing case, even showing her the deed, you know, which is the name of the story, which is in his name. And the narrator even knows the man vaguely from her work as an attorney. He's also an attorney at another firm. So we're never sure, at least I was never sure, if it was all in the narrator's head or the most convincing case of gaslighting ever. But of the five stories in the book, all are told in the third person except this one. This is in the first person. And I wonder, is that because the reader, since it's being told in the first person, the reader never knows if the account is reliable, if it's all in the narrator's head, or if it's really kind of the reality of the story?
Right. I mean, clearly she is a somewhat unreliable narrator. And yet I think of her as totally reliable because her experience, I mean, I think the story is a projection of her interior landscape onto the actual reality of her life. And that's really how she feels, as if the things she supposedly owns, she doesn't really own, that there's somebody who's wanting to, you know, grab it away or deny her. And she just doesn't feel a sense of entitlement.
Yeah, and that's where the first person just works so well. And not just that person trying to take it away from her, but he actually has some legal proof.
Exactly.
It's like the whole system's working against her.
It's kind of the nightmare scenario, you know, a little bit Star Trek, you know. Yeah, I don't know.
I think somebody once said, when I was reading reviews on Amazon, it's a little Twilight Zone.
Twilight Zone.
Yeah, to
yeah,
it.
That's
yeah.
My name, Twilight Zone. The funny thing about that story is I used to have in it something about parallel lives that I ended up taking out. But I actually remember workshopping it when I was in the MFA program. And it aroused a great deal of controversy for all the reasons we're talking about. And there was a really heated discussion about it. And I knew I was onto something. So, you know, when you get that much ire going in the room, you know, you've got something that's probably working.
Oh, I I loved all the stories, but this one, like I said, it's the one that kind of really sticks with me because I felt so bad for her. You're kind of in her head too, and these things are happening, but you don't really know if they're happening in real life, you know, in quotes, in fictional life.
I put it first because I figured that it would be kind of jarring to read some realistic stories and then encounter this one that was a little Twilight Zone-y.
Now, the second story, Fad, that's about a young art student. Her name mm-hmm. is Tasha. She lives in New York City. And she's taking a life drawing class. She becomes obsessed with one of the models, who's an oversized woman named Jane. That's where the title mm-hmm. comes in. You said the story was actually salvaged from a novel that you sidelined, you sidelined. But you felt the part about Tasha and Jane was worth saving. And it certainly goes with the theme of the book, Vanishing. Mm-hmm. At one point, Jane says, "You live in a body like mine, and you don't exist for most people. You're invisible." Was that theme of invisibility, of not being seen, what attracted you to this section of the original novel?
I think so. I loved that. And I also loved this encounter between two women who were so unlike on some level, but so alike in other ways, and form a kind of an unlikely bond. And yes, the invisibility of Tasha having newly arrived in New York City and feeling really unseen and uncertain. And she arrives thinking she's a really wonderful artist and then discovers she's not as great as she thought she was. And she has a difficult mother at home, but she feels unseen in the city and is ambivalent about whether that's a good or a bad thing. And then Jane definitely feels unseen as well, due to her large size. And, you know, I know myself, I, like many of us, often will not look at somebody if it's uncomfortable, if they have an uncomfortable aspect to their body in any way. I don't mean to. I try very hard to engage people in eye contact, but it's not always easy.
And of course, in the story, Tasha is judging Jane right from the start, based entirely on Jane's body.
Right, right. It's interesting. In one of the reviews of the book, there was a comment about how all the stories comment on bodies. I thought, is that true? Isn't that how everyone writes, commenting on bodies? This seems perfectly natural, an avenue into character. And then I began looking more closely at them, and I thought, and I saw, well, clearly in the story, Fat, it's very body obsessed. But then I began to see, with the possible exception of the first story, that bodies do figure fairly prominently. So I don't know. I got thinking about other writers who are like that. I mean,
Oh yeah, you wrote an article on the body in literature. You mentioned Lydia Yuknovich, several other writers who kind of embrace the body in the sexuality, the kind of the more what we would consider the more disgusting parts of the body. But
exactly. I admire those writers a lot. I feel I still have some blockage against going the full distance in that regard. Maybe having grown up in New England and having a certain puritanical aspect to myself, I can't quite go there, but I really admire writers like Lydia who do.
But there's also, in addition to the body, there's also that theme of drawing as a way of seeing beyond kind of that first impression, which is certainly what Tasha had of Jane in her body. I want to tell you, after reading the story, I came upon this full-page cartoon, which was in the Sunday New York Times. It was May 24th. And I think you would love it, too. The writer of the article slash cartoon is Wendy McNaughton. And she and her wife decided during this pandemic quarantine to do a drawing exercise together. Did you see it?
I saw that, and I loved it. And I thought, I have to do that with my partner. I think we would enjoy it so much. I mean, it's really beyond my normal purview. Uh-huh. I really think of myself as a terrible artist. I think I had a middle school art teacher who I remember one time distinctly. She came up to whatever I was working on and started drawing on my page, clearly indicating that I was not doing it right. And I have ever since felt really inhibited as an artist. But I thought this would be a great disinhibiting thing to do.
Yeah, I should mention the exercise they did, Kai.
Finish describing it.
Yeah, so they're sitting face-to-face, very close to each other, and they're drawing each other for 4 minutes, but they can't look down at the paper. They just have to look at each other. They've only got 4 minutes. And what her takeaway was, and it fit in so well with the story, at the very end she writes, "A drawing is a way of looking, a way of paying closer attention to things we often overlook or take for granted, that invisibility. You might discover something you've never noticed before. Drawing helps us see one another," which I loved. And I actually think that was a part of the story Fat.
Exactly. I had the exact same feeling when I saw that piece. And I just thought this was made for the story.
Now, I'll get to the third story. And I'm not going to go over every single one like this. Well, there's only five. But the third story is the title story. So it's called Vanishing. And you recently wrote an article for Ms. Magazine. It was a Q&A with a friend of yours and a fellow author, Amy Liu. And you said the story is probably the one that borrows the most from your own life. It's about two longtime friends. One's going through the early stages of dementia. And it starts with this great first sentence. Betsy Wainwright's brain was shrinking. There's a significant twist near the end. So without giving that away, because I think that's important for the reader to discover on their own, what'd you take from your own life experience when writing the story? Did you have a friendship like that, or do you?
Vanishing was the most autobiographical story in the collection, sadly. I do have my oldest friend from when I was 3 years old contracted, I'm not sure if that's the word, that sounds like it's infectious, mm-hmm. but was diagnosed with early onset dementia. Not Alzheimer's, but some other form of dementia. And she's been in decline for a number of years. And she and I share many, many experiences from childhood through our teenage years. I went on trips with her family. Some pretty significant trips, like a pack trip in the North Cascades when her father was somehow he was head of the Sierra Club at the time, and he was assigned with delivering an opinion about whether the North Cascades should be made into a national park. So I was on this pack trip with Kate, my friend Kate, and her parents, and we went, you know, on horses up into the Cascades, and we had a guide named Elmer, who carried a gun. I'd never seen anyone carrying a gun before. We had mules carrying our stuff. And every night, Elmer set up camp and made us dinner. I mean, it was really extremely luxurious camping. And at one point, when we were going over a bridge, one of the donkeys fell and broke his leg, and Elmer had to shoot this donkey it was, I mean, a very memorable experience for me. Partly the gun and partly the death of the donkey, and we had to leave this donkey by the side of the trail. Anyway, that's all of those experiences kind of got vacuumed away when my friend Kate was diagnosed with dementia, and her parents were deceased by then. And so I had that feeling of great chunks of my life being available to no one but me. And usually, you know, there's a shared memory with at least someone, a sibling or a parent or a partner or a friend. But there it was, whoosh, gone, poof.
Poof. Yeah, that's actually what I wanted to ask about. The theme of vanishing, it takes on a physical presence in the story with Betsy's brain shrinking. In addition to the psychological, which are the memories she shares with her childhood friend, Marty, which is kind of your fill-in here.
Yeah.
A fictional alter ego. And with that vanishing, Marty's afraid her own memories, as you just said, as a big part of her identity is also disappearing, or she's the only one that has it, and does it really exist then? And there's that line we read earlier, that the poof, she felt gone to him along with all those years they spent together, poof. And that theme runs through a lot of the stories. Do these women, do any of us really have an identity separate from our relationships with our partners, our parents, our family members?
I think that's a really good question. And it really came squarely in front of me when I divorced. And I had the same feeling of, you know, we were together for 20 years. It was not a short marriage. And we'd done so much. We, you know, had those years in filmmaking together in New York, and then we moved west, and we had a child, and all of those things seemed to have less of a fulcrum in the world without him around to discuss our memories. And I did for a while feel very, I wondered what to do with those memories and how to celebrate them. Because to me, they were still things that needed to be celebrated. And because I had put together the photo albums, I took them with me. And I have the photo albums. And recently, I just copied a bunch of the pictures for him and gave him a book, because I felt like it was a way to kind of keep those memories going and revive them in some ways and give them new life. But it's still an issue. I mean, that vanishing of memory.
There was one sentence that really struck me, too. There's not just the vanishing of memories, but there's certain memories we'd rather not remember. You have the line in there, Marty's thinking. So again, your fictional alter ego in here, who's visiting her friend, Betsy. How easily certain things were extinguished. And other things, the very ones you wanted so desperately to erase, were the very ones that clung so tenaciously. I mean, who can't relate to that?
Yeah. Exactly. Oh, my gosh. If only we had control over our memories, right?
Oh, one day. You know, I mean, there's been a lot of science fiction on that topic, but I think it's probable at some point, I don't know, 10 years in the future, 100 years in the future.
Well, there was that movie, right?
Well, there's been several where they've implanted memories.
Or they erased certain
Or they erased,
memories,
yeah.
They?
Yeah. I think there was an Arnold Schwarzenegger movie. Wasn't it called Eraser or something like that, where they erase people's memories? Or anyway,
yes, it has been a theme that people have visited.
Yeah,
but there's one
fiction
movie I'm trying to think of in particular, the Spotless something.
Oh, the one with the Jim Carrey. Boy, it's a very long title,
dear.
But I know exactly what you're talking about. Yes.
Yeah.
And they erase the memory of a love affair that he had. Now, we kind of alluded to it earlier, but I want to talk about the role of surrogate mothers in your work.
Oh, okay. Can I say one thing about vanishing before we move on to surrogate mothers?
Go ahead.
I just want to say that everything in vanishing is not autobiographical.
I didn't mean to imply
no,
that.
No, no, no. I know. I mean, there's some things that happen at the end that never happened in reality.
Oh, okay. So, and that's,
I just want to clarify that.
That's the twist we do not want to give away.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay. But it's a fictional twist. Happens in the story. It didn't happen in real life, but
right. Thank you.
So the surrogate mothers, again, we kind of talked a little bit about it earlier, but these are usually women who have a complicated, often dysfunctional relationship with their own moms, and they find someone to whom they're not related as family bloodlines to serve as a surrogate mother. And that was the case in your novel, Weather Woman. There was a surrogate mother in there. Two of the stories here, Fat and Redhead, have what you could be called, what can be called surrogate mothers. And you've said in an interview, I'm interested in the way we as women often find mother surrogates or daughter surrogates as a way of repairing the things that might have gone wrong in that early mother-daughter dyad. Can you talk about the appearances and that appeal of these mother surrogates in your fiction?
Well, I've noticed myself doing this through the years, and I have found it a really wonderful way of, as I say, repairing things that I feel might have gone wrong and redoing them in better ways. As for, and so, because I've seen it in my own life, it's been a motif that I have gone to without even thinking about it in fiction. I think all our early relationships inform the relationships we form thereafter. And so with women, I mean, I think women tend to have very intense relationships with one another. And the early model for that is with one's mother. So it just seems like a natural outgrowth of what happens as one goes through life. And then, of course, when one's mother is not around because you've left home, or one's mother deceases, then it's wonderful to find people who can do for you what your mother did for you in good ways.
I want to talk about another autobiographical passage here in the story, Redhead. The mother surrogate here is Esther. And after her real daughter, Isabel, dies, she forms a relationship with the main character in the story, Morna, who had a romantic relationship with Isabel's husband, Dan, before the marriage, but barely knew Isabel, but pretends she knew a lot more. So a little complicated, but I'd wonder if you'd read, there's a wonderful section near the end for us, which I don't think gives anything away, but it's just beautiful, and I think it really illustrates this kind of mother surrogate, and then we'll talk a little bit about the biographical element in there.
Morna stopped 10 feet or so behind Esther. After a few minutes of stillness, Esther turned. "You are the expert," and she lifted the nightgown over her shoulders, and it billowed with a slight breeze. She dropped it into the grass and stood in the buff, her pale, quasi-lit body both statuesque and sagging. The matronly swoop of hip and belly, the thickly muscled calves and dainty ankles, the breasts loose as testicles. Fleshy and thin, beautiful and despairing. She waited, weight swung into one hip like Venus de Milo, hair adrift. "Yeah, show me, teach me this. We do it together."
And of course, that's Esther talking that last line. So you write pretty well about the body there. that's a pretty strong.
I know, there are.
And in an article for Miss that came out in March, that article on the body, you wrote, "Throughout her life, my mother was a champion of skinny dipping. And when my sisters and I were young, she used to take us outside to dance naked in summer rainstorms. I loved the mischief of our nakedness. I loved watching the rhythmic bobbing of my mother's breasts as she danced." And again, just a beautiful passage on the body, and you use that kind of like the shooting of the donkey in the previous story.
I think that because my mother was very coordinated and loved her body, she really loved what it could do, and she celebrated the body and the naked human body, and she was a little mischievous about it. She knew it was a little bit maybe frowned upon by neighbors, but she did it nonetheless, and I think it opened up in me a kind of a curiosity about the body and also a love of the body. And I think my mother was one of the few women I've known in my life who actually loved her body. And I, you know,
well,
not very many women do.
Well, here that, you know, that both of them naked together in this kind of almost joyous scene in a very sad place, the grave of Esther's daughter, Isabel, in the cemetery at 3 a.m, I should mention. It's just a beautiful way of expressing their relationship to each other, that kind of surrogate motherhood that Esther takes on and Morna also is part of as the daughter, surrogate daughter.
Right. And it continues, there's a little deception, I will say, that Morna is pulling off with Esther. But even after Esther kind of sees that deception, she still is willing to play.
It's something that they both need.
Both need it. Right.
Now, you've written recently about the experience of launching a new book during the pandemic, and I know it's been hard for every author. You work years on a book. You wait for publishing often a year or two once it's finished before it comes out. And now this, where it's hard to get out there and read at bookstores. Well, you can't really. And you mentioned, though, despite these challenges, some positive things have come out of it. What are those silver linings for you?
Well, when the quarantine kicked in, for about 3 weeks, I was in pig's heaven. I was just euphoric. And even though this was when Vanishing was coming out, and the reason for my euphoria was the fact that, well, I'm a writer and kind of a hermit, and all of my responsibilities fell away. I didn't have to go anywhere, do any readings. I didn't have to, I mean, really, literally, like the rest of us, my life kind of imploded or something. But for me, it just opened up more time to write, more time to think, more time to read, and I was really, really delighted, actually. I mean, I felt bad for the rest of the world, but I personally was delighted. And then, you know, all the Zooming kicked in, and I realized, okay, now that's what we're supposed to do, and I have been trying to get on board with that. But so for me, the silver lining is that time to think, because there is a lot about the world that legislates against deep thought. I mean, we all think, of course, that's the way we get through the world. But really, deep thought, I mean, ruminative thought, the thought that gives rise to good writing, I think, is kind of scarce. And
because we're all so busy, or we were pre-pandemic.
We're all so busy.
Yeah, now you have time. I've tried to take daily walks. That's something I haven't done before. It's just a lot of things that you would normally do, go out shopping. Now it's, you kind of cut down on that, or you try to.
Right. Even like I've been doing Zoom yoga, but I used to have to, you know, allow time to drive there and change and, you know, whatever. And now I just, you know, 5 minutes before the class, I open my computer and there I am. And, you know, there are a lot of good things in addition to all the bad. I mean, if our democracy survives, then I think we will learn a lot.
Kai, you mentioned that you have extra time for writing. I know you had one novel we talked about before when you came in for Weather Woman. It's a sequel to that book. It's called Sinking Islands. And I think that's all completed and that's due out next year. But are there other writing projects that you're taking the time during the pandemic, during this quarantine to work on?
Well, during the first few weeks of the quarantine, I completed a new novel called Hair on Fire, which really began with my rage that came up during the Kavanaugh hearings. And I just have not been able to let that rage go. It just is always kind of bubbling there. So that came out in a novel that it has nothing to do with Kavanaugh or anything like that. But the novel does hold that rage in it, and it's called Hair on Fire. And then that's with my agent, and I now am working on a totally new novel called The Animal Novel. That's the working title, at least. I don't know if that will stick.
And I know a lot of writers would rather not talk about current projects like that, so I won't press you on that if you didn't want to tell us anything more.
I could tell you what it's about, but I feel like I would really A, shock you, and B, maybe interfere with the process.
Well, Kai Emmons, again, thanks so much for joining us today via Zoom, as we've all been communicating during this time.
Thank you, Ken. This was very enjoyable.
We've been talking with Kai Emmons, author of the new story collection Vanishing from Leapfrog Press. You can find out more about Kai and her work online at kaiemmonsauthor.com. I'm Ken Jones, and this has been Between the Covers on KBOO Community Radio. Many thanks to Kai for joining us today, and to all of you for listening.